It is Friday, December the 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, Islamic State claiming deadly attack in Afghanistan.
Islamic State apparently is becoming a greater threat now for the security of Kabul because since early October, there have been 7 suicide bombings in the Afghan capital.
Children in conflict zones suffering from shocking levels of violence. Issues facing rural America. Plus the sounds of Kenneth Bruce Gorelick. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Afghan officials are saying dozens have been killed, almost 90 others wounded. Happened in a suicide attack on a building in Kabul. A spokesman for the Afghan Ministry of Public Health told reporters 4 women and 2 children were among those killed in the blast. Reporter Ayaz Ghul speaks now with VOA's Sarah Williams about that attack.
Well, what we understand from statements the Afghan Interior Minister has issued as of this moment that there were apparently several attackers involved in this deadly assault on a cultural center which has ties to Iran in a very secure part of Kabul. And it was a well-coordinated attack in a way that there was a small bomb that went off in the beginning. And when people gathered around the area in the basement of this building where the cultural center was located, then the suicide bomber blew himself up. That is why it caused so many casualties. And then there was a third blast, we understand, according to initial investigation, which happened when more people rushed to the scene, ambulances rushed to the scene to collect the victims, to take them to the hospital, then the third blast went off and it caused additional casualties. So as of this moment, we know for sure that more than 41 people have been killed, including women, and around 90 people have been wounded in this one of the deadliest attacks in recent months in Kabul.
Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack. This certainly sounds like it was carefully planned.
Yes, that is interesting to explain that Islamic State apparently is becoming a greater threat now for the security of Kabul because since early October, there have been 7 suicide bombings in the Afghan capital that have killed a total of 130 people, and all of them were against either worship places of the minority Shiite community or their processions. And as we saw once again, Islamic State targeted another Shiite-linked facility in Kabul. So it is, according to Afghan observers, now becoming a major threat than the Taliban insurgency, particularly for the city of Kabul, where we see a lot of security in place, but still this group has been able to carry out so many suicide bombings within 2 months.
It's interesting because Islamic State has been apparently weakened in the Middle East, in Iraq and in Syria. It almost seems as though it's gaining strength in Afghanistan.
Yes, that is what we even heard Russian officials saying only last week, that according to their intelligence information, currently the number of Islamic State loyalists in Afghanistan is around 10,000 fighters. And the Russian presidential envoy for Afghanistan, Kobolov, claimed that fighters who have fled Syria and Iraq are also now arriving in large numbers in Afghanistan and joining the ranks of the Afghan branch of Islamic State. So obviously, it's not only Russia, but Pakistan and Iran. All the neighboring countries are worried at this increasing strength of Islamic State, and they have been trying to create an alliance so that they could deal with this threat, which is now becoming dangerous in a way that the Islamic State fighters are targeting mostly civilians in Afghanistan. And that is obviously creating big problems, big challenges for Afghan security forces who are already struggling to contain advances of the Taliban insurgency.
Reporter Ayaz Ghul speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. Also in the news, the U.S. Justice Department says 2 Romanian nationals alleging that they have hacked the Washington Police Department's surveillance cameras before President Donald Trump's inauguration on January the 20th. Mihail Alexandru Ivancic and Evelyn Shishmaru were arrested in Romania this month over the incident, which compromised Washington's Metropolitan Police Department camera computers as part of a ransomware scheme. If there is one word, one single word that has dogged and defined Donald Trump's presidency, It is Russia. VOA White House correspondent Peter Heinlein has a look now at Mr. Trump's relationship with Russia and the Kremlin's role in his election and how they've dominated the president's first year in office.
I have nothing to do with Russia. Everybody knows it. That was a Democrat hoax. It was an excuse for losing the election.
This was Donald Trump at year's end, pushing back against allegations that he is soft on the Kremlin, possibly as a payback to Russia for helping him beat Hillary Clinton for the presidency. In January, 2 weeks before Trump was sworn in as president, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper's office issued a finding that the CIA, FBI, and NSA had together concluded that Vladimir Putin tried to ensure a Trump victory. Putin, it says, ordered a campaign to denigrate Secretary Clinton and harm her electability, and that Putin developed a clear preference for Trump and aspired to help Trump's election chances by discrediting Clinton. The finding prompted immediate congressional investigations. In March, FBI Director James Comey confirmed that his agency too had a probe, looking into possible collusion between Trump's team and the Kremlin. Soon after, Trump fired Comey. That led to the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller, whose far-reaching Russia probe has already netted indictments and guilty pleas of several Trump campaign officials on peripheral charges. As president, Trump's words and his deeds have at times seemed to be at odds with each other. He recently approved the sale of lethal weapons for Ukrainian forces fighting Russian-backed separatists and signed into law new sanctions against Moscow for its actions in Ukraine, though he called the legislation seriously flawed. But in speeches, he still talks about trying to improve relations with the Kremlin.
And I feel that having Russia in a friendly posture, as opposed to always fighting with them, is an asset to the world and an asset to our country, not a liability.
His national security strategy casts Russia as a dangerous competitor that seeks to weaken America's global influence using subversive measures to undermine the legitimacy of democracies. But in a speech unveiling the strategy, Trump talked of building a partnership with Putin.
Well, yesterday, I received a call from President Putin of Russia thanking our country for the intelligence that our CIA was able to provide them concerning a major terrorist attack planned in St. Petersburg, where many people, perhaps in the thousands, could have been killed. They were able to apprehend these terrorists before the event with no loss of life, and that's a great thing, and the way it's supposed to work.
Analysts say Russia has become the prism through which Trump's every move is viewed, putting the president in the position of possibly being tougher on the Kremlin than he might otherwise have been.
It's almost as if he's trying to overcompensate so that people won't assume the worst about him in Vladimir Putin. So you saw recently the measure allowing for the sale of weapons to Ukraine, which was something that the Obama administration had blocked for years while Ukraine was being invaded and there's still a war going on in Ukraine. That's a very strong move.
Donald Trump's second year in office promises to be, like the first, dominated by Russia, as special counsel Robert Mueller's probe is moving inexorably toward a conclusion, and the president pushes back as he faces off on the world stage with the only person ranked by Forbes magazine as more powerful than he, Vladimir Putin. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, The White House.
And still ahead on International Edition, mounting anger toward the computer and mobile phone company Apple. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new report by the UN Children's Fund finds that 2017 has been a particularly brutal year for children caught in conflict, as children around the world have been subjected to shocking levels of attacks by the warring parties in these places. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says there is no safe place for children caught in conflict. The report finds children are being targeted and exposed to attacks and brutal violence in their homes, schools, and playgrounds. This in blatant disregard of international laws established to protect the most vulnerable. The report presents a numbing catalog of abuse and conflicts around the world, in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and even in Europe, in eastern Ukraine. It reports children are deliberately targeted, used as human shields, killed, maimed, and recruited to fight. Children are raped, forced into marriage, abducted, and enslaved, and UNICEF says the physical and mental impact of this brutality upon children is unbearable and deeply traumatic. This video of Rohingya refugees on a riverbank in Bangladesh, newly arrived after fleeing violence in Myanmar, is heartrending. It shows groups of weeping children and a severely malnourished baby treated by a UNICEF doctor. With the right nutrition, some of these starving children will survive, but many others will not. The report details the direct and indirect price children are paying in several African conflicts. It notes a dramatic increase in violence in Central African Republic has led to children being killed, raped, abducted, and recruited by armed groups. It notes 850,000 children have been driven from their homes in the Kasai region of Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 19,000 children have been recruited as soldiers by armed groups in South Sudan. And in northeast Nigeria and Cameroon, at least 135 children have been used as suicide bombers. UNICEF says children are killed, maimed, denied access to food and water, and pushed to the limits of suffering from malnutrition, disease, and trauma. It says this happens in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and other conflicts where the rights and needs of children are violated with impunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Late Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Tip O'Neill famously once said, "All politics are local." Well, the adage is especially true in rural communities in the United States, far from the corridors of power. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan went to Lassen County in Northern California to see how local politics and the community involvement go hand in hand.
No, we run cattle here, basically, grow some hay, sell hay.
But when Jeff Hempel is not working on his land, he's an elected supervisor who helps to run the county government.
I ran for school board, ran for the college board years ago, decided to run for Lassen County supervisor.
Among the issues he is dealing with, the return of endangered gray wolves to Lassen County. Ranchers say they are killing some of their cattle. California wildlife officials argue that the wolves pose little danger, but the community is working to get their voice heard in state and national politics. They say they are dealing with regulations imposed from afar, a decline in the timber industry, and limited services. It's a long way from the state and nation's capital to Susanville, the Lassen County seat.
It's isolated. Isolated from Sacramento, to a degree also Washington, we've been left alone.
And like most of California, this rural county faces periodic wildfires.
Fires down in Ventura, we've had the fires up here in Northern California, and I don't honestly see how the state is going to manage the recovery.
But self-reliance and community involvement are a way of life here.
If you want something done, then go out and do it. If you want a better city, a better county, a better country, then volunteer and get it done. Don't just wait on the government to come along and do it for you.
A key to getting things done in this polarized era is negotiation and compromise, says another resident who got involved in politics.
To me, that's the biggest issue, is finding ways to common ground, because without that, we aren't going to have a country.
That's a challenge throughout the United States and in Lassen County, where people say they are doing what they can to make their voices heard. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Susanville, California.
Now it's time to find out what's trending on social media with Doug Menard. What you got for us, Doug?
You know, with the New Year's holiday coming up, I think people are really sort of not thinking much about news per se. There's not a lot of conversations going on out there. But, of course, that doesn't mean that people still don't like to complain. And here is something that a lot of people are complaining about. It has to do with Apple's iPhones, the older versions of the iPhones. It was recently discovered, and Apple has now admitted, that it was intentionally but secretly throttling back, in other words, slowing down its older iPhones, iPhone 5, iPhone 6, those kinds of things. Now, they say they were doing it for various technical engineering reasons. But for a company that's so famous for its secrecy, that has not mollified a lot of people. A lot of people are very upset. And, of course, this coming on the news now, just released today, I believe, that Tim Cook, his 2017 take-home compensation pay was over $100 million. So here you have the new iPhones going on sale for $1,000. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, taking home $100 million-plus dollars in 2017 and all, just alone. And now people saying, but hey, wait a minute, my old iPhones, you're intentionally slowing them down. And they're using the hashtag BatteryGate to discuss their unhappiness. Here's Steve Wyatt on Twitter. Apple devotee since 1984. Hashtag BatteryGate is the last straw. Here's one anonymous here. Apple's hashtag BatteryGate couldn't have come at a worse time. That obviously a reference to Mr. Cook's compensation. Steve Grinstead, this is annoying me more and more. Jeffrey Gold, if Tim Cook gets a 74% salary increase, does that mean the battery on my old Apple iPhone will also get a 74% boost? The answer there is no. But again, lots of people are upset. There is now talk about perhaps lawsuits, perhaps class action lawsuits, and even some regulatory agencies in the United States and Korea and elsewhere are getting involved, saying, you know, this may amount to unfair practices and something that needs to be investigated. So hashtag BatteryGate's trending right now, and it's serving as a platform for a lot of people to express their disappointment with Apple.
Guess what, Doug? I've got an Apple. Ah, am I disappointed? Sometimes, I have to say. VOA's Doug Menard. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The most widely accepted theory for how the solar system was formed asserts that the sun and planets were formed from a giant interstellar cloud of gas and dust. Now, a new theory proposed by scientists at the University of Chicago suggests the solar system could have formed in a windblown bubble that surrounded a giant, long-dead star. The scientists think that the huge star was more than 40 to 50 times the size of our own sun and flung off tons of various elements from its surface. They theorize that these elements formed a dense bubble-like shell around the star. Researcher Nicholas Dofus from the University of Chicago says the shell of such a bubble would be a good place to produce stars because dust and gas become trapped inside where they can condense into stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Guess what? Now it's time for a little something from the world of music. sounds of Kenneth Bruce Gorlick, better known by his stage name Kenny G, an American saxophonist and jazz artist. Songbird is from Kenny G's fourth studio album, Duotones. It was released in 1986, and it was one of the best-selling albums of all times. Plus, Songbird reached number 4 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 chart. Kenny G was born in the U.S. city of Seattle, Washington. He came into contact with the saxophone when he heard a performance on the Ed Sullivan Show. He began by playing the alto sax, eventually the tenor, and then concentrated on the soprano sax, with the musical spotlight soon to follow. Kenny G collaborated with many artists on his numerous recordings, part of his rise to become the biggest-selling instrumental musician ever, global sales well over 75 million records. Tony Braxton is one entertainer with whom Kenny G joined forces on their super hit, How Can an Angel Break My Heart, co-written by Braxton and Babyface. G earned a place in the Guinness Book of World Records in 1997 for playing the longest note ever recorded on a saxophone. Using circular breathing, he held an E-flat for 45 minutes and 47 seconds at J&R Music World in New York City. That same year, his song Havana from the album The Moment went to number 1 on the Billboard Dance Club Play Songs chart. Havana and so many of Kenny G's hits are always on his playlist, as he performs to sold-out concerts, including his current Breezing and Breathless tour with George Benson. That just might be my favorite Kenny G song. However, I love Tony Braxton, so it's hard to say. You make up your mind, and thank you for making up your mind to listen to the Voice of America today, an international edition. Always good to have you with us. Top Roll News is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday. Now some more from Kenny G.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of inexpensive, reliable energy delivery is one of the chief obstacles to growth and development in sub-Saharan Africa. Nearly 70% of people living in the region lack access to electricity, forcing them to spend significant amounts of their income on costly and unhealthy forms of energy, such as diesel fuel to run generators and kerosene for lanterns. But if there is one thing Africa is not lacking, it is sunshine, and that means a lot. Indeed, for some of the world's poorest people, it makes all the difference in the world. A little more than a year ago, Power Africa, a U.S. government initiative coordinated by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and Power Africa's partners, the United Kingdom Department for International Development, Shell Foundation, and the African Development Bank launched the Scaling Off-Grid Energy Grand Challenge for Development, with a focus on pay-as-you-go solar home systems. The challenge's goal is to provide 20 million off-grid households in sub-Saharan Africa with clean, affordable electricity by 2030. So far, the challenge has made 40-plus investments in early-stage, off-grid energy companies, which are expected to result in some 4.8 million new electrical connections. One reason for the success of the startup companies that have won grants from the challenge is the fact that the cost of solar technology is falling fast, so it is within the means of those who live away from traditional power grids. And thanks to the new system of mobile money and pay-as-you-go financing, they can purchase the solar power generating equipment they need and pay for it in daily installments from their telephones for as little as 15 cents a day. Thanks to these technological and financial innovations, many people are getting electricity for the first time every day. In these newly electrified communities, business can flourish, clinics may safely store vaccines, and students may study long after dark. Indeed, access to clean and reliable electricity can enable entire communities to escape the cycle of extreme poverty. The Scaling Off-Grid Energy Grand Challenge for Development Partnership, solar technology, and companies that bring light and electricity to off-the-grid homes and businesses are revolutionizing daily life for millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.